Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how it all affects our nation's future. This week, we'll take a close look at President Biden's fiscal year 2025 budget request, which he submitted to Congress on Monday, March 11th. Our first guest is Dr. Josh Gordon. He's Director of Health Policy at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And Josh will help us understand the healthcare proposals in the budget and how it fits into the broader context of controlling healthcare spending. And then we'll turn to Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, for a look at other proposals in the budget and how they add up. Concord Coalition Policy Director Tory Gorman and Chief Economist Steve Robinson join the conversation. Well, our first guest, Josh Gordon, leads the CRFB's Health Savers Initiative, and they work to find proposals to make healthcare more affordable. Josh, I should also say, spent 18 years with the Concord Coalition, including being Tory's predecessor as policy director. So we always like to welcome Josh back onto the show. Josh, Tory, and Steve, welcome back to Facing the Future.
Thanks, Bob.
It's alumni day.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we always have a gold star for all of our alumni that come back on the show. And so, Josh, healthcare, as we know, is an enormous part of the budget, and it accounts for much of the projected growth and spending, aside from interest on the debt. You follow this issue pretty closely, so I wanted to get your take on the president's healthcare proposals. First, just as a general matter, what stood out to you?
The funny thing, I guess, is that what really stands out is that these proposals are the same as last year's budget. That's one thing. That's not necessarily unusual or bad. It's just there wasn't much new other than one small provision, which I can talk about in a little bit, which we're very excited about. But the big picture is that the Medicare Trust Fund policies will make Medicare solvent for what they quote as the indefinite future, which is certainly good news. The problem is that that is almost entirely on the revenue side. And as we always say, and I know you always say this as well, it's important to slow the growth of healthcare costs and healthcare spending, along with bringing in new revenue into the Medicare program. So we'd like to see more on that end. But new revenue is very important, and they have a pretty big proposal to bring in a lot more revenue for the trust fund. And then you have, I think, teeing up what will be kind of the sort of Armageddon of fiscal policies when in 2025 all these tax cuts and other programs expire, and the next Congress and president will have to deal with them. And one of those policies is extending more generous Affordable Care Act marketplace subsidies. And the president's budget proposes about $270 billion to extend it beyond 2025. So those are really kind of the big picture items from the budget.
I know you've had a lot of proposals that that you've put out from the Health Savers Initiative. Is there anything related to those that seem like they should be nonpartisan and, I don't want to say no brainers, but I mean they should be relatively non-controversial. Any progress on that front?
Yeah, well, I mentioned there was one thing that was really interesting in the budget that I was excited about, and they have a provision to ban what are called facility fees for telehealth and other outpatient hospital visits. This is, I think, a really important start to a policy of site-neutral payments, which is something the Health Savers Initiative works a lot on. And these are simply, the idea that we should be equalizing how much the government pays for a certain procedure, regardless of where that procedure is performed. And one of the ways this impacts consumers and patients the most is in these so-called facility fees, where you go see your doctor, they happen to be practicing at a building owned by a hospital, they put their normal charges on the bill, and then the hospital adds a fee on top of that called the facility fee, and that is kind of like a surprise bill that you're not expecting to get. You don't understand why you're paying it. It's not going to pay your doctor for the service he just provided. It's only going to the company, which happens to be a hospital that owns the building. And I think facility fees for telehealth are the most egregious use of these, where you are talking to a doctor on the phone or on Zoom, and just because they are Zooming you from a hospital, the hospital then gets to make money on that through a facility fee. It doesn't make any sense. And so this budget bans those facility fees in the commercial insurance market. It only saves about $2 billion for the federal government, but it saves more in terms of private insurance costs, and certainly saves patients the hassle of getting these surprise bills. So I was excited to see that in the president's budget. I wish there were more site-neutral policies in the president's budget to save more money for Medicare. But I think it's a start.
Tori.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about Medicare drug price negotiations for a moment. To great fanfare, a couple years ago, the Democrats in their reconciliation bill, the president managed to pass legislation that would allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices, thereby presumably saving Medicare beneficiaries and the Medicare program some money. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that program and whether or not it's started up yet, and what kind of proposals there are in the president's budget regarding Medicare drug prices.
Yeah, I mean, I think the negotiation of drug prices is really a key health savers that has been enacted over the last few years. And the president's budget tries to expand the program. But I think when you look at how the program is designed, where we start with 10 drugs in the first year, which will be 2026, that are going to have negotiated prices. That negotiation actually right now is ongoing. The manufacturers just recently submitted their kind of opening response bid to the government selecting their drugs for negotiation. So those negotiations, quote unquote, will play out over the next couple years. At the same time, the drug companies are trying to sue in many different courts to stop this program. I hope they're not successful, because I think the government should be allowed to negotiate the prices it pays for drugs, just like the government sets prices for what doctors get paid for what they do. The government controls pricing for medical devices that we get when we have surgery or other health problems. And it doesn't make sense for prescription drugs to be the only product that the government has to take at whatever price the producers suggest. I mean, it doesn't make sense. We would not want the government to fall into that trap. We want the government to be able to reduce spending. And so I think having this negotiation power is crucial to the government being able to keep healthcare costs down. I would say that the way the original bill that actually passed was structured is you start with 10 drugs, then you go to 15 drugs, then you go to 20 drugs throughout the 10-year budget period. By the end of the original, I think, time period, you wind up negotiating over something like 50 to 70 of the most expensive drugs. When you look at drug spending in the United States, it is actually highly concentrated in the top most expensive and most used drugs. So by the end of the first decade, you've pretty much gotten a majority of the savings that you would get it for most of the drugs that patients get prescribed in Medicare, at least in large amounts. What the president's budget wants to do is enable the president to negotiate 50 drugs right off the bat which really, I think, brings savings forward in the budget window. But I think it doesn't ultimately change the trajectory of long-term prescription drug spending for Medicare. Because over certainly the first 20 years, all of the drugs are being negotiated that fit these certain criteria. So you haven't really done much more bending the long-term cost curve with the president's budget proposals. You're just kind of bringing it forward in time. So again, you're getting budget savings, and we always are in favor of reducing the deficit and having budget savings, but you're not doing much to change the long-term stability or sustainability of Medicare.
We're going to have to take our first break here and get into some of these healthcare issues a little bit more on the other side of the break. You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking about the healthcare proposals in President Biden's new budget, which was released on Monday. We're talking to Dr. Joshua Gordon, Director of Healthcare Policy at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking about healthcare savings or spending in the president's new budget that was just put out on Monday. And we're talking with Dr. Josh Gordon. He's Director of Healthcare Policy at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And when we left, Steve, you were about to ask a question.
Yeah. So, yeah, you mentioned in the first segment of the show that the budget this year looks a lot like the budget last year, and I recall one of the criticisms last year, including a criticism from me, was that they were engaging a little bit of double counting with regard to the Medicare program. Administration has proposed increasing the payroll tax and what's called the net investment income tax on individuals making over $400,000. And they're going to credit the increased revenue to the Medicare trust fund. But they're also proposing to credit the existing revenue, the money that we would have already collected under current law. They're going to credit that to the trust fund. And then we were talking about the drug price negotiation. And in theory, that will save money in the future. But they're going to credit that money to the trust fund, which, of course, this is the Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, which really has very little to do with the prescription drug benefit. But anyway, you know, the bottom line, I think the actuaries at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services said that the president's proposal would result in a transfer of about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years to the Medicare Trust Fund, and therefore extending the solvency presumably indefinitely. But when you go through the proposals, you know, that $1.5 trillion doesn't really represent new money that's available to pay for Medicare benefits. It's simply, you know, either future savings in drug costs, or it's money that we would have collected under current law. What are your thoughts about, you know, is that a real way to shore up the Medicare system?
Well, I mean, I'll start by saying that whatever new money we're raising by increasing the tax or applying the specific Medicare tax to new types of income, and you're generating new money and dedicating that to the trust fund, that seems fine to me, because that's what we want. We want new revenue to come in, and we want it dedicated to the trust fund to extend solvency. Where it gets trickier is when you're taking a current revenue source or prescription drug savings from outside of Medicare hospital insurance, and then dedicating that to the hospital insurance trust fund. That is more of kind of gamesmanship in a way, really an accounting trick more than gamesmanship, I guess. Again, if the new prescription drug savings is because of new policies, because you're extending negotiation or you're making those negotiations tougher, that's not what they're suggesting, but that would be one way to bring in more savings into the system, and then dedicating that to the trust fund, it makes sense. But taking an existing revenue stream and just saying that is now going to flow into the trust fund is a gimmick, because we're not actually increasing the resources of the federal government. We're just moving it from one arm of the federal government to the other. I would also say, though, that Medicare is increasingly, I think, anachronistic in having this division between hospital insurance and outpatient spending in Medicare Part B. We really think that these divisions aren't very helpful. Medicare Part A is actually shrinking relative to Medicare Part B. So there are a lot of reasons to kind of change the way we think about that division, but that I think is a much bigger reform than a president's budget would ever be able to handle. And certainly we could have a whole nother show on how to do that. So in a way, like any policies that is increasing revenue and cutting spending is good. And then there's kind of a separate issue of whether we're doing some accounting gimmicks also to make the trust fund last indefinitely versus 20 years versus 15 years.
You're raising a really important point that when we talk about Medicare reform, people often think of it as extending the solvency of the one particular trust fund of Medicare, which is not the biggest problem within the Medicare program. You know, the SMI doctors and, you know, outpatient services are more expensive and growing faster anyway, and have an automatic pipeline to the federal budget because, you know, they don't have that that trust fund constraint that Part A has. So, yeah, we tend to focus too much on Part A because it makes it easier to sort of game trust fund solvency and then declare that, you know, you're shoring up Medicare. But Tori, you wanted to get to a different issue, so let me get back to you.
I want to talk a little bit about the premium tax credit. For those of you who are unaware, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, said, listen, if you don't have access to subsidized health insurance and you make a little bit too much money to qualify for Medicaid, we're going to help you purchase private insurance on the exchanges, the health exchanges. There have been some changes to the premium tax credit recently, Josh, and there are some more changes that are included in the president's bill that I think are very relevant when we talk about this whole host of tax cuts that are expiring in 2025. Premium tax credit is one of the ones that is affected by that, and we haven't really had much of a conversation about it in the public sphere about it. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about premium tax credit, recent changes, and what the president's budget proposes to do with that.
The changes to the ACA tax credit started, I think, with the CARES Act, or one of the COVID emergency legislation made those credits more generous. Basically, you could earn more money and still get a good subsidy from the government to purchase health insurance on the individual market. And then they've extended those out a couple different times to now where those more generous credits will end in 2025, which is, as we talked about in the first segment, sort of a Lollapalooza for fiscal policy expirations. We're going to have trade-offs between what tax cuts are we going to extend, what are we going to expire, what spending programs are we going to extend, what are we going to expire. Obviously, I hope we come out of that with something that doesn't increase the deficit beyond what the baseline would be, which, as I'm sure you've told your listeners about for the last year, is just huge unsustainable deficits for the indefinite future. So we don't want to explode those with what we do in 2025, but I certainly think it's worth discussing the trade-off of, are we going to spend the money on tax credits? Are we going to spend it on tax cuts? And figure out a way to make the right fiscal decisions at that point.
Let me make a note of that. You say that deficits are unsustainable. we'll do a show on that. We'll do a show on that later. Josh, before we go, I want to change gears a little bit and talk about something that gets a lot of attention from time to time, which is, if we invest more in preventative care, will that help bend the cost curve where we actually save money? It often comes up in the context of putting more money into certain things. And, you know, there's really nothing wrong with prevention. I'm all for it. But the question is, does it actually, you know, can we count on it to sort of pay for itself?
Yeah, we wrote about this recently because there's been a movement in Congress to force the Congressional Budget Office to have long-term scores for legislation that invests in healthcare wellness, I guess you would say. And I think this is a big issue because Congress has to consider whether to allow the new obesity medications to be paid for by Medicare for weight loss, which they currently are prohibited from doing. And it also comes up because the president's budget actually proposes to eliminate hepatitis C, which has a lot of short-term costs that the administration says over the long run will get paid back in savings for curing the disease. And this is a kind of an interesting question. And I always hate to be kind of the doomsayer here, but I'm very skeptical that a lot of these investments in health and wellness ultimately save money over the long run. That doesn't mean that they are not worth doing or investing in. Certainly, if people are sick, we shouldn't have arbitrary limits on what Medicare pays for if the medication is paid for in other parts of the system. But I think members of Congress think all of this stuff is going to be free or bring back more money than it spends. And that's very rarely the case. I don't think the Congressional Budget Office is going to score that as the case. They've done research before where something like 80% of the historical look at these programs show that they do not save money, because you're spending a lot of money on a lot of people that might not have needed that spending in the first place, just to save money on a smaller subset of the population that would be cured or that would be better off over the long run from those investments.
Well, I was just going to say, it's a little bit ghoulish, and I know where you're coming from, because, you know, you don't want to say prevention is a bad thing, but if you're keeping people alive, this is a terrible example, but I mean, if somebody dies of a heart attack at 60, but you keep them alive and they're 90, I mean, you're going to spend a heck of a lot more on people that would, you know, and I'm not suggesting that you don't do it. All I'm suggesting is that I don't think it would necessarily get the payoff. But I know Steve would like to jump in on this, but we don't have time. So what I'm going to suggest is we do another whole segment on this at some point on the impact of preventative spending on healthcare. But for right now, we're going to have to take our second break. You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I have been talking with Dr. Josh Gordon of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget about healthcare proposals in the president's budget. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are discussing President Biden's fiscal year 2025 budget, and we're joined now by senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, Brian Riedel. Brian has been a guest on this show before, and more importantly, he's worked on Capitol Hill as the chief economist to former Senator Rob Portman. And he was staff director of the Senate Finance Committee on Fiscal Responsibility and Economic Growth. He's also worked at the Heritage Foundation. And Brian, he's certainly one of the more prominent budget watchers in Washington. So we wanted to get your take on the budget. Just as a big picture thing, you know, how do you think people should view this budget?
Well, first, thanks for having me. Of course, I've worked with the Concord Coalition for more than 20 years, and all of you are terrific, and we've worked together a long time. Always glad to be here. I mean, the president's budget's really not something that should be taken literally, of course, because it's going to be DOA in Congress, just like last year's budget was DOA in Congress. But it is helpful for laying out the president's vision. A good deal of the policies he's going to push Democrats to support and the policies he could veto. So it is a helpful vision. Ultimately, I think my problem with the president's budget is it's a classic tax and spend budget in an era when serious deficit reduction is required. You know, as we know, budget deficits under a current policy baseline are headed as high as $3.5 trillion over the next decade, and even that's with interest rates not rising much. And in this budget, there is about $5 trillion in new taxes. But instead of pairing it with $5 trillion in spending cuts as an all-out assault on the deficit, most of the new taxes just go towards new spending. And that is not only not helpful with the deficit, I would argue that it actually makes deficit reduction harder. Because if there is $5 trillion in plausible taxes out there, you need to use it for deficit reduction, because otherwise, when we finally do get to deficit reduction, all the best tax-raising policies, all the tax-the-rich policies are now off the table. They're gone. So now when you finally get to reducing the deficit, which we have to do at some point, now you have to tax the middle class. Now you have to do the harder stuff because you've already used up the easy stuff. So I think ultimately, even before you get to the gimmicks that make some of the numbers fake, the overall approach of marrying higher taxes with higher spending is a step backwards for the deficit, not a step forward.
You know, in that regard, I was playing with the CBO's new interactive tool, you know, where you can type in savings and then, you know, see where you come out in terms of deficit reduction and the debt to GDP ratio. And, you know, I think it would take about $6 trillion worth of policy savings, plus another $1 trillion in interest to stabilize the debt at today's ratio of GDP. And, you know, you mentioned that the budget has about $5 trillion in taxes. So let's say you took all of those and did nothing on the spending side. You still couldn't stabilize the debt to GDP ratio, you know, at where it is now. It's kind of a measure of how deep the problem is. The president's budget, with all the spending increases and tax increases that you've talked about, kind of stabilizes the debt. I don't know what after 10 years, but it's kind of like at 106% of GDP, you know, a little bit higher than it is now and just below the all-time record. There's 3 years, I think, where it's like 106% of GDP and the record is 106.1 and it never gets there.
Of course, that's by the White House accounting.
Yes.
Again, once you adjust for the gimmicks, once you allow CBO to take a stab at the numbers, I think the numbers are going to be much higher for the deficit. But certainly, I think the White House may have made a conscious decision that we can't have the opponents call this the highest debt in American history. So we need to keep it just a hair under the peak of World War II, where it peaked at about, I think, 106.1
was the record. And so it doesn't take much to get over there.
So one of the claims that this budget makes is it saves about, what, $3 trillion over the 10-year budget window. Yeah. We all know that every president, Republican or Democrat, includes budget gimmicks to make their budget appear more fiscally responsible than it really is, whether it's using puffed up assumptions about economic growth, whether it's keeping certain spending categories artificially low, or whether it's literally just shifting money around, you know, underneath where nobody can see anything. Mm-hmm. So I would ask you, I think I know the answer to the first question. Are there gimmicks in this budget? Yes. But what might they be? And are they more or less egregious than what you've seen in the past?
I think on a policy level, they're necessarily more egregious because, Tori, you and I have seen some really egregious gimmicks over the past couple decades. I think the difference here is the size of the policies, the amount of money that's covered up. Keep in mind, as you said, the budget claims to show about $3 trillion in deficit reduction, but they take out the cost of extending the Trump tax cuts for those earning under $400,000. President Biden has repeatedly endorsed extending the tax cuts for families under $400,000. He has said there will be no higher taxes for such families. That's a cost that's as high as $2.4 trillion, depending on who you ask. They just leave it out. Additionally, on discretion, or actually, we'll stick to tax policy, he also does a one-year extension of the child credit back at the 2021 levels when it was up to $3,600 per family, but only 1 year. We all know how this goes. When Congress does 1 year, of course they're going to extend it. That cuts out about $800 or $900 billion in costs. And then on the discretionary spending side, something virtually all presidents do is assume huge discretionary spending cuts way out in the future when the, after they leave office. This budget assumes discretionary spending falls below 5% of GDP for the first time since the 1930s. That's $3 trillion. So that's, if you account the tax cuts, the child credit, and discretionary spending, that's about $6.5 trillion in gimmicks. And we haven't even gotten to the rosy economic assumptions compared to the Congressional Budget Office. But if you include this $6.5 trillion, that's $3 trillion in deficit reduction suddenly becomes a deficit hike. And that's why I wouldn't focus as much on the aggregate total of spending and revenue and deficits 10 years from now, because essentially the numbers are fake.
Steve?
Yeah. So in talking about, you know, looking at the general direction of things, one of the new proposals that the president had unveiled in his State of the Union was what he called the billionaire tax. He basically said, you know, billionaires, they've got to pay their fair share. He actually said there was 1,000 billionaires, which I was really curious. I didn't know that anybody had an accurate census of the number of billionaires. So I was surprised when the budget came out this week, and it turned out that the number of billionaires is irrelevant, because the tax that he's proposing starts at $100 million.
Yeah.
So if you have $100 million in wealth, you have a minimum 25% tax. And it was, and of course, the difference is, unlike the income tax where we tax your income, we can count your income and we tax it. This is a wealth tax, which supposedly is based on the market value. And if you hold stocks and bonds, obviously you can create a market value for that. But it also applies to intangible assets, things that, you know, presumably if you own, you know, a Mona Lisa or, you know, whatever, you own works of art or various other items, you know, they're going to tax you on that at a minimum tax. I mean, what are some of the pitfalls of, I mean, haven't other countries in Europe, for example, tried wealth taxes and they end up repealing them because they're just too hard to administer? Or what's been the problem with those?
Yeah, this is another pretty gimmicky policy. Again, a billionaire tax that starts for people making who have one tenth of $1 billion. So even from the name, you know we're not going down the most honest road there is. But the minimum tax for billionaires, as you say, is unique because essentially it's a wealth tax. They're not just saying 25% of your income as we normally have defined it, but 25% counting stock market investments. This is mark-to-market accounting, and it basically becomes a wealth tax. In 1990, 12 European countries had wealth taxes. Right now, just three do. And the reason Europe got rid of wealth taxes is not because, you know, France decided they love rich people. It's because they were enormously expensive to administer, complicated, led to money shifting overseas, and in the end raised very little money. So they were basically considered more trouble than they were worth. And even if you kind of, it becomes more of a mark-to-market kind of tax, where again, you're taxing investments on the value that they rise or drop, even if they're not sold, really almost no country even tries to do mark-to-market taxing anymore because it is so complicated, unwieldy. As you say, you have to value assets every year, private businesses, work of art that aren't sold in the open market, and therefore we don't really know what the price is. There's even liquidity issues. If you have a large private business, how are you going to pay a big tax on your business becoming more valuable without selling your business? You don't have the money. It's tied up in where you work. This is the sort of thing, I hate to say it, this is put... Proposals like this exist because they sound good in speeches, not because they're remotely workable. And
that's amazing.
This isn't going to go anywhere.
Do you think a president would actually do that?
I mean, so I guess, what I mean is it's almost silly to even analyze these policies because they're such gimmicks.
Okay, well,
they're not intended to be passed.
We'll be back with more silly analysis after, or analysis of silly policies. Right after these short messages, you're listening to Facing the Future. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and I'm here with Policy Concord Coalition Policy Director Tori Gorman and Chief Economist Steve Robinson, and we're joined by Brian Riedel, who is Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We're talking about President Biden's fiscal year 2025 budget. You know, when we left off, you and Steve were having a conversation about the tax proposals, and you made an interesting observation during the break that I wanted to get back to, because it's not exactly making the tax code easier or revenues easier to collect in some ways.
Yeah, the president is making tax policy a hostage to his talking points. The first talking point being no tax hikes under 400,000. The next talking point meaning wealth taxes basically over 100 million. And in doing so, the president is essentially creating three completely different tax codes for the three income groups, which is why all these new tax the rich policies all have to start at 400,000 and have to be designed in awkward ways to not touch anybody under 400,000. A lot of tax cuts all have to be very awkwardly stopped at 400,000. Even policies that aren't based on your income, they have to find a way to work your income into it. And then, like I said, creating an entire new system of wealth taxes where they're basically redefining the tax base completely over 100 million when you're earning over 100 million. And the complexity here is amazing. You basically are going to have three totally different tax codes for three different income groups. There are ways to have a progressive tax code without doing it this way. There are ways to have higher marginal tax rates without necessarily creating totally different tax codes. And the complexity here is going to be enormous. And complexity leads to a lot more money for accountants. And it also leads to a lot more loopholes and a lot of people being able to evade taxes. And so I think the complexity here is a problem. That's why the pledges like the $400,000 pledge, the $100 million cutoff, they're great applause lines. They don't really work in policy.
Very difficult to administer those things.
Yeah.
Tori.
So one of the criticisms of the president's budget is it's being perceived as a campaign budget because, you know, shock, we're in a campaign year. This is a presidential election year. And oh my gosh, President Biden's put out a budget that is largely a campaign document. Okay. My question, Brian, you've advised presidential campaigns in the past. I'm curious, mm-hmm. Do you think that we will see budgets from the other candidates for president? And should we?
I'm old enough to remember when presidential campaigns put out full detailed budget plans and bragged that they were scored by a bunch of professional economists. In fact, I worked on some of those campaigns, Romney 2012, Rubio 2016, where we worked for weeks putting together budget plans. Now, granted, they weren't necessarily bound to those budget plans when they took office, and they would sometimes do things more irresponsible, but it at least brought a sense of reality and approach. With Trump and Biden, I think these are the most policy-free, budget-free campaigns and candidates that we'll see in a long time. Trump's not going to put out anything on budget. And if you want to know what Trump's going to do on budget, I guess you just look back at what he did during his first term. I would not expect Biden to do much else beyond the essential campaign document we have now. So we're going to end up with a policy-free campaign.
Steve.
So let's go back to the tax the rich theme that we've talked about a little earlier. I mean, you know, if you ask public opinion, I mean, most people think that either the rich don't pay any taxes, or I think as President Biden said in the State of the Union, that the rich pay less than the middle class. So there's this sense of sort of resentment potentially that politicians can tap into to say, look, you know, those rich are getting away with paying nothing, mm-hmm. or they pay less than you do. And so there's a general consensus that, yeah, the rich should pay their fair share, they should pay more. But it's not ever really clear what a fair share would be. You know, mm-hmm. how much should the rich pay? I mean, do you think that there is a real resentment that we ought to tax the rich at punitive, you know, 70, 80% tax rates? Or is it a matter of fairness that if you could convince the public that, yeah, we have a fair, simple, flat tax system, not necessarily flat in terms of the rate, but the idea that everybody pays roughly a similar percentage. I mean, would that be enough to sort of satisfy most people? Or do you think the desire for, you know, redistribution is so great that the higher rates would prevail?
The tax progressivity debate is completely untethered from reality. It's completely untethered from what the data says. I wrote a report last year called The Limits of Taxing the Rich. And one of the things I noted in this report is the United States has the most progressive tax code in the entire OECD. And this is based on what they actually pay, not just the rates on paper. Additionally, our top tax rates for the rich on income, capital gains, corporate, and estate are actually higher than the OECD average. And we collect just as much money from the rich as Europe. The idea that the rich don't pay taxes or that they pay lower rates than, you know, your secretary is simply not true. But it persists because there's always one example we can point out to of one company that didn't pay tax one year or some rich person who didn't pay tax. And it also persists because we want it to be true. If it's true that the rich don't pay taxes, that means we have a huge untapped revenue source for deficit reduction in government benefits that won't cost most of us any money. So we want it to be true. The numbers just aren't there. That's not to say that we can't tax the rich more. The report that I did last year actually mapped out how much we can raise from additional taxes on the rich. What I determined was, if you ignored the economy and went for revenue maximizing in all areas, you could get 1 to 1.5% of GDP from taxing the rich. Not nearly enough to close a deficit, heading to 8% of GDP, over the next 10, 15 years. And even in a report I'm writing right now, I do propose some new taxes on the rich because everything needs to be on the table. But we got to get away from this idea that we can just tax the rich and solve all of our problems. One other quick stat on this. If you seized every penny of net worth from every billionaire in America, every home, car, yacht, business, investment, everything they own, every bit of net worth from every billionaire, you could fund the federal government one time for 9 months. And then it's gone. So the idea that the rich are this bottomless supply of potential tax revenue, the numbers just aren't there.
We have a couple minutes left here. Could you describe in detail the proposals in the budget to prevent Social Security from facing insolvency in 2033?
The trustees have said that within 9 years, the Social Security Trust Fund will go insolvent and trigger a 23% automatic cut in benefits. President Biden's budget doesn't do a single thing to avert Social Security's impending solvency and benefit cuts. Nothing. The president kind of gives a nod and says, we need to look for a way to solve this. If you look at the numbers in his budget, they seem to assume a general revenue bailout because they assume benefits just keep going without Social Security trust fund revenues growing as much. And a general revenue bailout not only breaks the link between revenues and spending that we've always been told Social Security is based on, but it also just moves us towards the debt crisis route because you can't just keep bailing out Social Security and Medicare without a debt crisis. So for all President Biden's talk about he's the one who's going to protect Social Security benefits, if his budget were enacted today, binding under current law, Social Security would be cut 23% in 2033 if you do these budget numbers. There is no proposal specifically to change Social Security law in this budget.
Thanks for joining us, Brian. We've been talking with Brian Riedel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. one of Washington's most noted and quoted budget commentators. And Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I will be back again next week with another edition of Facing the Future.